Good morning. The Senate Education Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Wednesday, March 9th, 2022. The time is 9:04 a.m. Senators in attendance are Senator Begich and Senator Hughes. Myself, Senator Holland is chair. Senator Stevens and Senator Michicki may be joining us shortly. Thank you to Mary Gwen, our recording secretary, and Talia, our moderator today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. Today, we will continue to work on Senate Bill 225 relating to teacher apprenticeship programs. I'll now bring Senate Bill 225 back before the committee. This is the second hearing on SB 225. I'll welcome Senator Stevens to the committee. Good morning. Today, we're joined by Amy Vinlove from the University of Alaska. Did I say that correctly, Vinlove? Ms. Vinlove is going to help us lay some additional foundational knowledge regarding the current teacher certificate processes and pathways. Ms. Vinlove, welcome to Senate Education, and thank you for joining us today. Please state your name, affiliation, and begin your presentation.
Thank you. Thank you so much. My name is Amy Vinlove, and I am the director of the School of Education at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I also currently have the title of chair of the University of Alaska College of Education Consortium, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to present to you today. I haven't talked to you before, so I thought I'd give you just a little bit of my background so you understand what informs my knowledge base. I am a lifelong Alaskan. I attended school K through 12 in Fairbanks. Fun fact is that my parents came to Alaska in 1970 when I was 6 weeks old because my dad was hired to start up the Alaska Rural Teacher Training Corps, which was the state's first Indigenous teacher preparation program. Provided a fully funded pathway to a place-based opportunity for people in rural communities to become teachers. I've been working in this sphere since birth. I got an undergraduate degree in education studies and public policy. I didn't originally think I wanted to become a teacher, but after graduating and having some experiences working in some elementary schools, I did decide to pursue teaching, and I completed a year-long post-bac licensure program to become a certified elementary teacher. And that's sort of relevant because I'm going to be talking about different pathways to teaching. I taught elementary school in the Fairbanks School District for 8 years. I subbed before I was hired there, and this was back in the day when positions were very competitive. I actually applied for a position teaching in the North Slope Borough and didn't get it, but I was hired in Fairbanks. So I taught for 8 years, and during that time, I did become one of the first people in the state to become a National Board Certified Teacher in middle childhood education, and I've maintained that certification for the last 25 years. I also was the recipient of a Milken Educator Award during that time. So I mentioned that just because I do have a pretty strong background in the actual classroom practice before I came to the university. So I've been working in elementary teacher preparation at the university for the last 20 plus years. I worked in the elementary preparation program doing both teaching and supervision, which brought me all over the state to work with our interns who were in all kinds of communities, including Shishmaref and Kotzebue and Kodiak, Nightmute, as well as in urban communities. And during that time, I also completed a PhD through the University of Alaska in education and policy, looking at the practices of teaching culturally responsive teaching to our pre-service teachers in the University of Alaska system. I've also served in a position of accreditation coordinator at our university in education in preparation for 4 different site visits from the National Council for Accreditation of Teachers of Education, as well as from the Council for Accreditation of Educator Preparation. And I serve as a volunteer site visitor for the Council for Educator Preparation. I have been the director of the School of Education since 2018, so about 4 years now. And I have with me on the line Scott McManus, who's the superintendent of the Alaska Gateway School District, and I'll give him a moment to introduce himself.
Quick question from Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Dr. Vinlove. Appreciate your being here. Could you talk to us a little bit about the consortium, what that is, how long it's been around, what the job of that? The consortium is?
Yeah, so the consortium is the University of Alaska education program array working collaboratively together to ensure that we're meeting the needs of the state of Alaska. So it is the University of Alaska Southeast School of Education, and there are two representatives on the council from that. The consortium is all of us who work in the sphere of educator preparation for the state. But on the council, there is two people from UAF, myself and a faculty member, two people from the University of Alaska Southeast, myself and a faculty member, and the same from UAA School of Education. And then Paul Lair, the vice president from the system-wide office, also attends and is on the council. So we work together and meet every couple of weeks to keep everybody on the same page.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So that's is that a fairly recent organization? Is that after
started off in July of this past year that we organized into that particular structure?
July of 21?
21.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'll ask a quick question. DR period always throws me off. Are you more properly referred to as director or doctor or either?
Amy is fine. I do have a PhD, so I'm a doctor, and that's I'm comfortable with any titles.
All right. Well, thank you. Superintendent McManus, if you'd please state your name, your affiliation, and your location, and provide your introduction.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, Chair Holland and the members of the Senate Finance Committee. This is the Finance Committee, correct?
Close. Education. That's okay.
Education. I've been doing quite a few presentations, and I wasn't certain. My name is Scott McManus. I'm the superintendent for Alaska Gateway School District. I've been with the district for 24 years. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I'm a product of the UAF School of Education, graduating from there in 1988 with my teaching certificate, armed with that, and with a degree in political science. And I've taught all over the state, mostly in the bush. I grew up in the bush. Some of you know my background, so I won't go into that too heavily. But I was very excited to learn about the programs that the university is doing. I can tell you that they are significantly different from when I went there. And that's kind of how I ended up meeting Amy, to be honest. One of the programs that the university is working on, and I'm here to support and answer questions from the perspective of a school district.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Amy, please proceed.
All right. So I'm going to try to give you sort of a deep dive into what it looks like to become a teacher through the University of Alaska right now, and feel free to tell me to slow down or speed up or interrupt me at any point. So a couple of key terms that I think are important for people to understand. The first one is the difference between what's called an initial licensure pathway and an advanced preparation program. Initial licensure pathways, and this is a key distinction with our accreditor, is somebody who's getting their very first license to teach. So it's kind of the heaviest lift. It requires the most amount of field component hours as well as coursework. An advanced preparation program adds an additional endorsement or certificate area. Our accreditation is divided into those two different buckets, and I'll show you that on a separate slide, but this is a key distinction. The current accrediting body that we report to is the Council for Accreditation of Educator Preparation. There are two CHEA-approved accrediting bodies for educator preparation in the U.S. right now. CAPE is by far the largest of the two, has been around longer than the other one. There are 431 accredited programs under CAPE right now. And all three schools of education in the UA system do possess CAPE accreditation at either the initial or the advanced program level or both. I'm going to be referring to GYO, which are Grow Your Own programs, and those are referred to very frequently. There's a lot of different meanings for them, but basically it's anything where you are recruiting and training teachers from within local communities. They range from high school programs to parapro to professional programs, parapro to teacher programs, and in between. And I'm also going to make reference to a national learning network that we're part of called Prepared to Teach. It's based at the Bank Street College of Education, and it helps districts and universities collaborate to create sustainable systems for fully funding high-quality teacher preparation. So this kind of gives you a path to become a certified teacher, pretty much anybody who is a certified teacher is going to have gone through this pathway. There's really no opportunities to skip any of these steps, although you can enter into the pathway at multiple different points. But teaching licensure across the United States requires a high school and a four-year bachelor's degree, and then some sort of clinical fieldwork experience. So we're going to come back to this when I share with you some strategies for recruitment. But this does tell you sort of the basic sequence. People can come through it through traditional pathways. They start college and they know they want to become a teacher, and that would be the top set of triangles there. Or the bottom sort of talks about different points along the way that you can enter into that pathway. Whether you're coming in through a middle college program, or you're a career changer, or you already have a bachelor's degree and then you're getting a one-year degree. Yes.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back on that last slide, if you don't mind. I don't, you know, we're proposing this piece of legislation, the basically the apprenticeship program, and it's not one of your triangles here. So my first question is, where would it fit in there? And then the second one is, given our immediate needs, where would we want to, you know, outside of this bill, where else would we want to focus to be able to address the immediate needs for teachers in the state?
So I think on that second question, if you don't mind, we'll wait until I think you'll kind of get more of that down the line. The apprenticeship typically would be associated with that final internship. So there are sort of three different terms that are refer to a year-long approach where you're spending a year in a classroom under a certificated teacher, a highly qualified certificated teacher, and you have that really intensive experience. And so we, in the UA system, we've always referred to those as our internships, but they are relatively synonymous with an apprenticeship program and also with the term residency. So all three of those terms kind of mean the same thing. But apprenticeships can be structured in ways where they encompass more than a single year. But typically, you'd be looking at a one-year apprenticeship.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Go ahead, Senator Begich.
Just as a follow-up, I think what we're contemplating is something a little different than that. Mm-hmm. And it is sort of a combination of tapping into paraprofessionals and maybe a more extended apprenticeship than what you're describing. So we'll get back to that later, though,
okay.
I'm certain.
Thanks. So this is a sort of a simplified picture of our initial licensure program array within the system. There are actually 31 different permutations of this, but this tells you at least the different levels that we prepare teachers for. So there's early childhood programs. At UAA, there are other programs that are prior to the licensure available at other institutions in the system. We have elementary, which in Alaska spans the kindergarten through eighth grade, at the undergraduate and the post-bac level. So post-bac is you already have a degree and you're coming back for usually a 1 or 2 year program. Secondary, which is 7th to 12th, available at the undergraduate and the post-bac level. And then special education, which is also available at the undergraduate and the post-bac level, and a music education program.
Just another quick question.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so in this area, you know, When I did elementary ed and middle school ed courses, they were all during the day. Is there flexibility within these? Are some of these online? But I mean, if we're looking in non-traditional ways to get people in, it means we're probably bringing people out of the workforce. So do we have after-hours courses, or what are the flexibility? What's the flexibility?
There are all kinds of versions of these depending on the different programs, and even within a specific program. So for example, in the elementary program at UAF, the internship, the final year of preparation, has three different calendars. One is aligned with the Anchorage School District calendar, one is aligned with the Fairbanks School District calendar, and the other one is for our distance delivered students who are across the state, and their courses are intimately woven into their fieldwork experiences. So they're typically during the day. So they'll be working in a classroom on Monday and Tuesday, then they'll have coursework on Wednesday, and then they go back to the classroom on Thursday, and then they have coursework on Friday. Some of the programs are more geared towards students who are working full-time during the day and do have the after-hours course component. We get feedback on both versions. There's a lot of preference for the daytime classes because most of the people that we work with are non-traditional students. They have families. They want to be able to have some time in the evening to spend with their families, to do homework, et cetera. But we also create programs that align to the needs of people who are working full time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Dr. Benlove. This is an important slide. Will you be putting some numbers to these at some point in your presentation so we have an idea, UAF, UAA?
I do not have that slide in the presentation, but that's something that we can certainly follow up with.
Very great to see that. Just so we know where the students are and where the students are being, where teachers are being produced.
A brief at ease. Senate Education is back on the record. Dr. Benlove, please proceed.
This is the second slide that shows the programs in our system array here, the advanced programs. So these are programs for people who already have an initial teacher license, and they're adding on some type of a endorsement or a certificate to their existing license. So you can do that in education leadership, reading and literacy. You can become a school counselor. You can add on a special education endorsement, et cetera. So the next slide tries to give you an overview of how people end up in our programs. So the recruitment and marketing efforts of our programs across the system, we are coming at this from as many ways as we know how. we have a unified single website called teachalaska.org people can go to, and it's sort of a choose-your-own-adventure sort of approach where you can say, this is the credentials I already have, this is the content area I'm interested in, answer a few questions, and then it'll pop up and tell you these are the programs that are available to you right now in the University of Alaska system. We're employing search engine optimization to make sure that that pops up when somebody, for example, Googles become a teacher in Alaska. So that's something that's going on at the system-wide level. We also have a system-wide social media and marketing approach that we are engaged in, as well as social media and traditional marketing at individual campuses using Instagram. There's a sample of the ad on the right-hand side there. We have Facebook sites. We push out things on Facebook. We have YouTube videos. We have radio spots, et cetera. So those are sort of our traditional marketing approaches. And then we have recruitment efforts that target different points of entry. So you've probably heard of the Educators Rising program, which is run out of the K-12 Outreach Office at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, which recruits middle and high school students into the teaching profession and provides them with experiences to try to incentivize them to come into the profession and see that it's a good pathway to pursue in their post-secondary education. We have dual enrollment programs where you can take a class as a high school student that is going to give you credit towards your degree at the university. We have one called Teaching for Alaska's Future that allows people who are interested in teaching to learn about the profession, to learn about the programs that are available at the University of Alaska, and have some initial experiences working with children to try to get them excited about going into teaching. We also have middle college pathways. So with the Anchorage School District, there's a clearly articulated pathway if you're going through their middle college program to ensure that the courses that you take are going to feed directly into a Bachelor's of Arts in Education degree program at the University of Alaska. We attend college fairs. We visit high schools to talk about what it takes to become a teacher and what that process looks like. We offer a dual enrollment course through the Rural Alaska Honors Institute, so college bridging programs. And then when you're talking about recruiting folks who aren't in high school, who are a little further on in their life story, we have these parapro to teacher programs that I'll be talking about more. We recruit from youth professions, so people who are working with after school programs or pretty much any job that involves kids, we try to target recruitment there. We recruit from other majors, so if you're finishing up a four-year degree in English and you're not sure what you're going to do after you graduate, we try to grab you and go into one of your capstone courses and talk to you about what it takes to become a teacher after you're done with that four-year degree. And then I'm also going to share with you what we call laddered degree progression pathways, so you can have where you get incremental credits and you have some milestones along the way. I will say, though, that this is an extremely challenging time to recruit and retain teachers, as I believe you're all aware, across the entire United States. I just came from the annual American Association of Colleges of Teacher Education meeting, and the sessions that I went to on increasing enrollment in programs were standing room only, and this is the topic across the United States. You can see the sort of very depressing graph there looking at teacher preparation program enrollment just between 2010 and 2018. And I think that if we were to extend out that line, there would be an even further decline as a result of the experiences from COVID. We also ask our students when they are entering their final year of preparation questions about how they kind of got to the education pathway. And one of the depressing points, and this is one of the only depressing points I'll share with you because I like to keep things positive, but 53% of our students responding to this survey reported that somebody, a family member, a teacher, a friend, actively dissuaded them from entering the teaching profession, which is not a very happy thing to hear about. And the primary reason that they cite is financial reasons, but there's a lot of other things that are causing people to be discouraged from entering the programs.
Senator Begich.
I'm curious here, noting the 30% on financial. We have a student loan program. There are federal loans that are out there. There's the, for in-state students, we have the scholarship program. Is the university doing anything to help allay financial costs and for some of these students? And so is that an incentive we can use to attract people? And what are we doing?
I'm going to get to that. I've okay, got a good. Whole slide on that.
I keep anticipating you.
Thank you.
Can I follow up?
I'll follow up.
We used to have student loan forgiveness up here for students who took loans out and then came back, and we got rid of that in, I think, 1988 or 89, right around that time. So effort by legislature at that time to save money, that was why I stayed in state. I got my forgiveness. I came back. I was going to live out of state. And I decided to stay in state, get my forgiveness. Is the university talking about those kinds of programs at all when you get to that point as well?
Dr. Vinlove, so we're looking at 2020, 2021, I guess, for declines due to COVID. Is there a reason for the declines from 2012 to 2015? Anything identified in particular?
I would have to go back to the studies to see what they talk about. There's a lot of reasons, but I don't know what we're identifying. I mean, it's just basically an increasing sense of teaching just not being seen as a position that brings a lot of high esteem from the public, and also I think just the financial constraints around becoming a teacher.
I think it's significant to lose 30% of your.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. Please proceed.
All right. So the next four slides are going to just tell you a few real life stories of four of the students who are currently or recently completed our programs. Every student has a different pathway. So this is just four individual stories. The first one here is Anne-Marie Tinker. She is finishing up her Bachelor's of Arts in Elementary Education at UAF. She is from Kasigluk. She has been working in the Lower Kuskokwim School District since 2008 as a Yuktun teacher and associate teacher. She has demonstrated remarkable persistence in her journey to become a teacher. She has been working on it since 1995. From 2004 to 2021, she completed 3 to 7 credits a semester. And if you think about 120 credit degree sequence, this is a very long-term proposition, but she has stuck with it. She grew up as a Yuktun first language speaker and didn't know English until she started attending school. And she says that over the course of her teaching career as an LKSD associate Yuktun teacher, she noticed the decline of the Yuktun language among her students, and that inspired her to begin her teaching career and continue to teach her language and be an advocate for the program. and some of the barriers, and I'll mention these on each slide, that she's had to overcome on her journey to become a teacher are family obligations, the Praxis basic competency test, which I'll talk about later, and then also just financial barriers. But she has had and credited the support of her the Lower Kuskokwim School District in supporting their parapros to complete their licensure programs. The next one is Sheng Bang, and she just completed her AAS degree in early childhood education at the University of Alaska Anchorage. And she is now was happy that the BA in early childhood education has been approved. She's going to be pursuing that four-year degree. She is from Anchorage. She is a first-generation college student. She is on track to complete her bachelor's degree in 4 years. And she was inspired to become a teacher through the early childhood program at King Tech High School and had experiences there as a student teacher that made her feel that this she could become a great early educator through higher education. Mm-hmm. Some of her barriers have been also family obligations. She has 11 siblings, and also finding funding. The third pathway profile is Sylvia Andrew. She is completing a Bachelor's of Arts in Special Education at the University of Alaska Southeast. She is from Kiana. She's doing her internship now in Tuntutuliak. On her journey to become a teacher, she took credits at the Kenai Peninsula College, at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She got her AA degree in 2013, and then in 2019, she enrolled in UAS's BA and Special Education program and is going to graduate this summer. She was motivated to teach because she said in high school, they were told that we always need more Native teachers teaching in our schools, and that was what motivated her to become a teacher. And her son losing part of his hearing also led her to want to become a special education teacher. She has had to overcome barriers related, again, to family obligations and some interruptions due to COVID. And the final profile is a career changer profile. This is a student, Joseph Jackson, who completed our post-bac secondary licensure program at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He is currently teaching in the Anchorage School District with their virtual program. He completed his internship at the Polaris K-12 school. He received a BS in wildlife biology and conservation in 2017 and started his post-bac program at UAF in 2019 and had his certificate and his master's degree in education by May of 2021. And I'll just read his motivation to teach because it's quite lovely. He says, "Teaching is the hardest thing I've ever done. It's an occupation that society agrees is critical yet doesn't always appreciate. It's the only job I've ever had that's both lifted me to joy and broken my heart. Teaching represents a million potentials to positively impact young people and their respective futures, and regardless of how much it pays or what society thinks of it, that's enough for me. I never imagined myself as a teacher, but now that I'm here, I can't imagine doing anything else." And in terms of the barriers that he experienced, he said that the biggest hurdle was having to give up a full-time salary job for the year of unpaid student teaching I had to do. And Scott, I wasn't sure, did you want to also share about a pathway of somebody in your district?
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead and place yourself back on the record.
Yep, this is Scott McManus, Superintendent for Alaska Gateway School District, through the chair. So we have quite a few. We had a meeting with the University of Alaska Fairbanks in January, where we had been advertising with our staff that we were working on this program that would help and assist teachers to our staff and community members to become teachers. And we had 18 people right in there attend that meeting. They were very interested in it. These are people who've been around schools, who know what they're getting into, who have a variety of, they're down the path to becoming a teacher. Some are going to be graduating. One of them is going to be graduating actually this spring. She just came because she was interested. We have two that had degrees already and are now pursuing their an internship program with us. So we're excited about that. And we had a number of parapros who are looking at, you know, basically trying to improve their own family situation, because if you want to live in rural Alaska like these folks do, being a teacher is one of the better jobs that you can get, and sometimes it's out of their range, out of their reach, because of the time demands and the funding and all that that goes with it. So we've been helping our staff to do that. One of the staff who's going to be on deck next fall in one of our highest need schools is a nurse who just came out of the military. And so she has her degree and has now been working in the school as an aide and wants to pursue her career as a teacher and has everything she needs to file for that with the Department of Education and get the get into the Teachers for Alaska program. And she will be considered a new certified teacher next year, but we will have her in a mentor program. And so she is someone who we know has the temperament and the disposition and the core, you know, what it takes in her core to become a teacher. But she needs that time to work with kids and learn the skills and strategies that teachers are trained through their program. So those are just a couple of the I think, success stories that have happened already as our relationship with the university has grown. And, you know, we've seen right now what it's done for our teaching, filling up our teaching slots. We have, when I became the superintendent here in 2016, we had 50 to 60% turnover in our certified instructional staff. For the last 3 years, we've been bumping right around 90% retention. And I qualify that this is intentional retention. So for this year, we offered 38 contracts and we had 34 back in the first week. People who had committed, and we did that in January because that's the earliest we can do it. And right now I literally only have two more positions that I'm trying to fill. And two of them were filled by already this program that we're working with. So these are, I don't know if I'm the example of I went through a trades apprentice. So when I hear the term apprentice, I think of, you know, I was a cement mason, so I poured concrete and got muddy and troweled lots and lots of flat work. And it got me through school. I really think that it's important that we treat our teachers as interns. And there is I know it kind of means the same thing, but there is this difference. And it's one of the problems that I think we have, and Dr. Vinlow touched on it briefly, which was the status that a teacher has in America as a whole. When you see a 20% decline in people even interested in becoming a teacher, we're not recruiting from the teachers who are not interested. They've already made that career decision. So we're reaching out to 20% less teachers typically to come and fill our positions. And so what we have to do is be proactive, not try to, I'm really strongly against trying to make it easier to become a teacher. That is not the goal here. It is to broaden the scope of people who are interested in getting into the profession, not just make it easier. That would be a terrible mistake, in my opinion. And so we want quality people in front of our kids. That is the solution at the end of the day to the education problem that we're experiencing in Alaska. It's really finding people and certified, qualified teachers who are able to engage our students, who understand our students, and who are committed and will remain.
You have inspired quite a few questions, Superintendent McManus. I'll go to Senator Hughes first. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, and thank you, Dr. Vinlove, and Scott, appreciate it. One of the things I was thinking about, kind of a parallel profession and a pathway, is with physicians. And when they go to a residency program, they are actually getting paid. They're not getting paid what they're going to get paid when they're finished with it, but they are getting paid. And Joe Jackson's testimony here was that year of student teaching was really, really rough. And so I'm wondering if there's been any consideration. And whether in the mentor program, Scott, whether the teachers are getting any kind of stipend or pay, are they paying tuition in order to do that? And then Dr. Vinlove, is there any consideration for covering that year? Because to tell you the truth, if you've got a good student teacher, yes, they need to be supervised and mentored, but they are carrying a workload for that school. And for them to pay tuition, it almost seems like the district ought to be paying them to come in. So some conversation on that would be helpful.
Superintendent McManus.
So through the chair, Senator Hughes, you are 100% correct, and that is what we do. We, for example, last winter we had a teacher from New York New York State, upstate New York, and we provided her her airfare to Alaska, her travel to Tok. We paid for her room, and we gave her a we paid her as a non-certified substitute while she was here. And I required, in order to do that, we had to make a deal with the university because they didn't want to do that. They have rules, and I was very firm about that. I said, if we can't do this, then we're not taking that young lady, because it's not fair to her to come here, and for the exact reasons that you brought up. And so we required that they stay here for the entire semester. They had to be here on the first day. They went through our in-service training. They worked and took classes, and we didn't help them with their classes. The tuition was something that was outside of that, but I'm sure that if there were any motivation on this committee to recommend that, you'd have a lot of happy students. But for us, I agree, they are working, and I want them focused on what they're doing in the classroom, not on how they're going to put food on their table that night or where they're going to sleep. So it didn't really cost us that much for all the stuff that we did for her, and that school is trying to give us more students, and I can't take too many, so we're going to have to limit that. But we are also working on a similar program with the University of Alaska Fairbanks in the same vein. But I do believe that it has to be, you know, the full semester or even a full year if we can get it. We have a young student from the University of Alaska in our teacher practicum program, and we didn't pay them for the practicum, but we are paying them for their student teaching time. So that's exactly right. It is a commitment. To me, it's not a commitment to, they may not come and work for us, but it is a commitment to the profession. And that's what I think we should be doing.
And I see Dr. Vinlove, you queued up a slide on this particular
topic. I have.
Please proceed.
I have many, many slides on this because this is really the critical part. And so I will just kind of, I'll come back to the information about, I was getting into a deep dive of what it looks like to become a teacher, but I think that the money piece is really the piece of the equation that is most exciting to me in terms of things that are going on across the United States and opportunities that we have. This is from the Prepared to Teach National Learning Network. And it's talking about the fact that high quality teacher education is critical, but affordability is key. And aspiring teachers, as you said, can't work for free and learn how to teach well. So there are some really interesting things that the National Learning Network is doing to help facilitate and support conversations, planning, and co-construction of programs between universities and districts to figure out how to create sustainable braided funding streams for high-quality teacher preparation. So high-quality teacher preparation, there's a lot of literature that says that if you have a year-long residency, that is going to give you the best preparation that you can have. It's going to lead to increased retention, so you're going to cut down on your turnover problems in the long term. But figuring out how to fund that is the key part. So we talk about in our learning network reallocation, reduction, and reinvestment of funds between the school district and the university to create sustainable systems for fully funded high-quality teacher preparation. So turnover is a huge cost driver in schools, and we know that certainly here in Alaska. It also drives inequity in the education of our students. Pathways that teachers take directly affect the retention that they have in the school. So if you have a year-long embedded residency in a school district that you then go to teach in, you are way more likely to stick around and teach in that district. It also increases the diversity of our candidate pool. But money is the barrier to universal residencies because, as we said, candidates can't work for free. And that also creates inequitable access to quality preparation because of the costs. And fast-track programs that put somebody into a classroom before they're prepared can create reverse incentives to the system and further problems down the line. So what we're working with to learn about, and what I'm working in conjunction with the Alaska Gateway School District and Superintendent McManus and several other school districts across the state, is developing mutually beneficial partnerships that braid resources across the system between school districts and the university. Redesigning school roles to be able to pay residents for instructional supports. So looking at the positions that are available in the school district, the needs that the school district has, and then the university looks at the preparation pathway and says, how can we meet both needs by reallocating, for example, a half-day para pro position towards splitting it between two interns so that they're a para pro for half the day and taking their teacher education the other half of the day. And then getting paid half a para pro stipend or a salary in order to do that work. Or perhaps there are substitute roles in the building where you could take the money that you're paying to subs and use that money to pay interns, and then they sub 1 or 2 days a week and they do their internship the other days of the week while doing coursework, or after-school tutoring programs. So where are those opportunities for resources to be reallocated in a sustainable way within a school district? Also accessing financial aid. So you talked about the opportunities to, look, Wisconsin is, I'm going to go ahead to this slide. So Wisconsin has built a program at the university level where people will have their education. They will get a loan to become a teacher within the University of Wisconsin system. And then when they finish their degree, if they teach for 3 years in a high needs school or in a high needs profession, the loan is forgiven. If they're not in a high needs school or a high needs profession, it's 4 years and the loan is forgiven. That's an approach that's going on to look at costs on the university side. But the exciting part for me is looking at these braided funding streams and all these different buckets of money. So I've been working in teacher preparation for 20 plus years, and everybody wants to support people becoming teachers, but trying to get everybody on the same page is very challenging. So the idea here is that we are working collaboratively with a district, with the university, and with external forces. For example, our Alaska Native profit and nonprofit organizations have buckets of money to support people who are going to school. So trying to coordinate that for a student. So I kind of think of this as like a funding bingo card where you could sit down with an individual student and develop a individualized funding profile for them, looking specifically at their context, what funding streams they have access to, what district they're working in, what they qualify for automatically, what they qualify and would need to apply for. But this is the model that we are really excited about. And then also we'll get into this Department of Labor apprenticeship funds, because this is another one of the funding streams. But there are all of these funding streams that are already out there. And it's a matter of trying to get everybody on the same page and make sure that districts and the university are collaborating at a deep level to make sure that that everybody is benefiting and that the needs are met of our K-12 districts.
Director Vinlove, first of all, I appreciate you taking Senator Hughes' question and covering about 6 slides on it. That may be the only way we get through this today. I'll remind committee members there are 30-something slides here we're going to have to get through. There are 2 more questions from committee members. Senator Begich?
Thank you. My major question was already answered by the question asked by Senator Hughes, but 2 things I have to say. First, I have to put a conflict on the record because you've listed the Begich Scholarship on the right-hand source there, and I actually run that scholarship program, so I want to put that on the record that I've received no monetary benefit from this presentation, and I'm pleased to see it up there because we do fund it. But the question I had was the Wisconsin thing you described, the forgiveness, that would require us to change state law, though, wouldn't it, to provide a forgiveness?
I don't know how it works. It's with the University of Wisconsin University System, so I don't know if that would work internal to the UA system or if it would be a state.
Connected to that, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
So right now with energy costs, in LKSD, which you've mentioned a number of times in the presentation, they spend about $5 million on energy, $5.5 million on energy, which is about the same that the Mattsu School District pays for energy, even though it's substantially smaller population in Mets in LKSD. Mm-hmm. They have to divert money from their operating expenses to pay for that energy. So how can a school district that is struggling in paying its energy bills, which is most of our rural districts, how are they going to be able to use those resources or divert, substitute money and divert other money? How do we envision that happening when it really that sounds like it will benefit the urban districts that have cheaper energy costs more so than it would the rural districts where the need is greatest?
Well, I can't speak for each individual school district, but I know that the Lower Kuskokwim School District has run the numbers on how much it costs to recruit a teacher from outside of Alaska. And they have determined that that cost, and this is consistent across the United States, is so much, and it contributes to turnover because you get somebody, they don't stick around, and then you have to do it all over again, that they have for multiple years now reallocated, reinvested those funds into providing a fully funded year for interns during their last 2 years of preparation. So this already exists in LKSD.
Excellent. Thank you.
And Senator Stevens.
Well, amazingly enough, we all three had the same question. Thank you for asking us, Senator Hughes. But Scott, in your and good to see you. It's always great to see you testifying always on these issues. But you mentioned the young student, young girl that you brought in to become a teacher and the assistance you gave her. You did say that there was some resistance from the university in allowing you to do that. Could you help us understand why? What was the resistance and what needs to be done to make sure that you can do things like this?
Through the chair. That is a great question, and I would say that I believe that it is one of those things that relies on personal relationships with people. You know, if you find people who, Alaska is a small state, so we have these great relationships. I mean, Amy and I discovered, for example, that we probably met each other as children. I don't remember it, but it was very likely. Alaska is a small state in that way, so it creates these connections that are not, that I think create solutions that maybe aren't down there. The school that I was working with was a result of the Alaska Mentors Program. There was a fellow who came up to work with one of our schools through the state, and he had left the state and gone down to work at that school as a in their Department of Education. So because he knew us, he proposed that, and I had to work with their department, their school of education. And they didn't want to do it because I guess they didn't get to do it when they were in college. I don't know why. They were very resistant to it. They said it was against the rules, and I told them they needed to change the rules, and that we were willing, you know, I don't know what why they would be against it. It was a good thing for the student. We were willing to take the risk. We had to we treated it as a job. We interviewed the candidate. We, you know, not as a teacher, but as an intern, and made her kind of jump through some of those hoops. And we thought she would be a good fit in our school, and I just went to bat for her, and they caved, I guess. But they were quite resistant. When I did my student teaching, I did my student teaching at McKinley Alternative in Fairbanks in 1987. And it's not, McKinley Alternative isn't there anymore, but the principal was a fellow named Jerry Hartsack, who was teaching a class at the university. And he recruited me. And he said, I want you to come work in my school, but if you do, you're here on the first day and you're here on the last day. And so I had a year of experience in that school that was not paid. I had to pay for the joy of doing it, which I loved. The upside of, and you know, and I had a good job working in construction, so I was able to make that work. The upside of that for me was that when I stepped into a classroom of my own, I owned that classroom. I had no trouble at all. There was none of the jitters that I saw. I see now in other teachers coming out of systems where they do a lesser preparation program. I know this works, and it's something that it turns, and then I'm still here 34 years later. So I can just use that as as an example. I totally agree with the statement that when teachers get thrown into the deep end and can't swim, they get out of the pool. And that is not what we want. We want teachers who can do what they're asked to do and to feel like they're making a difference. And when you look at the research on why teachers stay, the number one reason is not money. It's on the list, but it's not the number one reason. The number one reason is because these are people who passionately want to make a difference. And I think it's up to us to assist them in being prepared to make that difference. And then they'll stay.
All right. Thank you, Superintendent McManus. Director Vinlove, where do you want to jump back into the slideshow? We were around slide 13 before.
Yeah. So I'll run through this quickly. You could just stop me if you want to know more about any of the pieces, but this just provides you with an overview of what it looks like to become a teacher through one of our initial licensure programs. I think that graphic at the bottom shows that we really work hard to integrate coursework with fieldwork and in an iterative fashion. So you are doing coursework, and typically you have fieldwork components with all of the courses that have to do with education. And then there are a shared set of assessments. So these next three slides are tables that just show the coursework and the fieldwork components of various pathways, elementary, secondary, and then special education and early childhood. And I've bucketed the coursework into sort of four different areas. One is the general education requirements of the University of Alaska system for a bachelor's degree. So those are consistent across the undergraduate pathways. And then a bachelor's of arts degree, which all of our education degrees are, as opposed to a bachelor's of science degree, have additional requirements that you have to complete in content area knowledge. And then there are education courses that you do prior to your final year of preparation, your internship year, and fieldwork experiences that go along with those education courses. And then there is the internship year, which for the majority of our programs is a year-long internship, like Superintendent McManus was describing, where you start on the first day, you follow the calendar of your host district so that you get that really embedded experience of what it's like to work in that particular district. So those are just the four different pathways there. And then the coursework and fieldwork experiences in our post-bac elementary, secondary, and special education programs. So again, these are programs for people who already have a four-year degree. They're much quicker, but they do have an intensive fieldwork component. Most of them can be completed in a year with that integration of coursework and the embedded field-based experience in the school. And then we have these laddered degree progression pathways. So this is to ensure that students are accumulating credits towards a degree, because there's nothing that is more heartbreaking than somebody who comes to us who's got 50 credits and only 15 of them count towards a degree program. So we try to create these incremental steps along the way to ensure that the, for example, 30 credits that you get in the local knowledge educator certificate, which are early, very early sequence courses. They have little to no barrier to entry, but they are degree, they count towards a degree. They're not developmental courses, and they are part of that Bachelor's of Arts in Elementary sequence. They also build into the Associate's of Arts degree, and then all of those 60 credits fold into the BA in Elementary Ed. In terms of the learning process within our teacher preparation programs, it's individualized depending on the program pathway, the experiences and the backgrounds of the faculty involved who develop the syllabi and the courses. But we do try to use what's called a learning cycle model to teach teachers how to facilitate learning that fosters 21st century learning skills and academic content. And so this model follows the four steps here of introducing the ideas that are, or the practices that you're trying to instill in your future teachers, having them prepare to do that in the classroom, enacting it in the classroom, and then reflecting on it. So as a quick example of that, I used to teach an integrated social studies and language arts methods course. And one of the strategies that we used was called building background knowledge, where we would teach the students about the importance or strategies for learning about what, pre-assessing student knowledge to find out what they already know on a topic that you're going to be diving into, and then developing a cumulative structure of introducing new material while also having the students reflect on what they know in relation to that material. So we'd go through that process. Then the students would build their own lesson in relation to the topic that they were teaching about in their classroom. This is an internship year course. And then they would actually teach it. They would capture it on video. They would submit the video to me as the instructor, and they would get feedback from their mentor teacher. And then we would look at some of that video in class after it was done, and we would reflect on it and learn from the experience. So that's an example of the learning cycle process. We have some pretty strict requirements about how we monitor candidate progress through our programs that we all have to adhere to as part of our accreditation process. We have also some very well-defined criteria as to ensure that our assessment tools are valid and reliable. So the accreditation standards for the assessments that we use with our programs require that we demonstrate content validity, which means that we have to work with our external stakeholders. So if we're assessing our students in their ability to monitor student progress in the classroom, we have shared that information with practicing teachers, said, is this a good assessment? Does this assess the things that you're using in the classroom? And we've established content validity on those assessments. We also have to establish inter-rater reliability with our assessments so that when we are doing field-based assessments in the classroom, our mentor teachers, as well as the site supervisors, so people from the university who go out into the field and observe the teachers in practice, and our faculty have all had to go through modules to establish that what the way that they are evaluating the students is going to be consistent with the way somebody else would evaluate the students. So we have to document inter-rater reliability. We have multiple evaluators to triangulate our observations. So it's not just observations from the mentor teacher or from faculty, it's from mentor teacher and faculty and the students themselves and from their site supervisors. And there's articulated criteria for program progression at all program points, and it all has to be aligned with established standards. So there are four key assessments that are used throughout the final year of preparation in our initial licensure programs that all have to have these meet these criteria on the left-hand side. We have a field-based assessment tool called the Skills of Teaching Observation Tool that's utilized by the mentor, teacher, supervisor, faculty, and the student self-assessment. We assess at multiple points along the progression of professional characteristics vis-a-vis those of a practicing teacher. We have a culminating performance assessment where we evaluate the ability to plan, implement, assess, and impact student learning in a positive manner through the development of a lesson, the implementation, capturing the lesson on video, and capturing student learning data and analyzing it. And we have state-level certification exams as well as subject or district-specific assessments. Our programs also, as a requirement of our accreditors, have to have a robust quality assurance system to demonstrate that we are engaged in a continuous improvement process. This is an example from the institution where I work, and it kind of tells you about the different steps that we have. We do actually have an entire quality assurance website that has all the background behind this. So our quality assurance system is made up, it's not going to work, but it's made up of different documents that say, okay, this is the array of sources where we're getting our data, our valid and reliable assessment tools. This is who collects that data, who aggregates the data. We prepare it for review. We get together then four times a year at continuous improvement data review meetings where we analyze the data and make program level improvements based on what we see. And I'm guessing this one isn't going to open either, but we have, nope.
We have,
anyway, so we engage in a standard set of protocols to evaluate data and to make data-driven decisions about program improvement relative to the various data sources that we gather. We also all have external advisory committees that are made up of individuals who work in the field, principals, teachers, superintendents, alumni, Some of them are disciplinary, some of them are based at the just with the whole institution, and we meet with them at least twice a year and get feedback on our programs and ask for input on new developments with those programs. Whoops, Alt Tab. There
we go.
How do I get back?
Up top, maybe. Is the way.
We also have to evaluate our graduates in the workplace. So after they graduate, it's a requirement of our accreditor that we survey them after their first year of teaching and that we survey their employers. So we all do this every year. And we also have to demonstrate that they are having a positive impact on student learning. So we have to gather data. Our institutions do that through the use of case studies. We do focus groups with our interviews every other year, focus groups with our graduates every other year, and collect impact on student learning data to demonstrate that. And the evidence does show that people are happy with their preparation at the University of Alaska, both the graduates, which is the third bar in each of those slides, and their employers. So we have pretty consistent positive feedback on our programs. And 96% of our surveyed in-service teachers say the rewards of teaching are worth the effort of their teacher education program. This is a very broad overview of program costs, and there isn't anything particularly noteworthy in this particular slide, just basically the tuition and fee costs. They can vary depending on the number of lower division and upper division credits, but those are pretty consistent costs across our programs. And of course, a one-year or a two-year program is going to be much cheaper than a four-year pathway. So we've...
Senator Stevens.
So I know there's a considerable difference between the various university sites, Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. And I do hear Scott saying the goal is not to make it easier to become a teacher, but to broaden it so we get more people in. Could you explain why UAS is only goes to 2 years, but UAA, UAF have a four-year requirement? Is there a difference there? Is there any concerns you have there? Are the teachers coming out equally as good, whatever school they go to in the university system?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, the difference is the top ones are four-year bachelor's degrees, and the bottom ones are for people who already have a bachelor's degree. And you can, most of the program pathways down there, almost all of them you can get in 1 year. It depends on how aggressive the student is. And majority of them finish in a year. And again, that gets back to the affordability question, because they don't want to take time off from wage earning for too long, and that sort of speeds up the process. But most of them can also be spread out over 2 years, but the cost is basically the same depending on whether you do it in 1 or 2 years.
So you feel it's not making it easier, it's actually producing quality teachers?
The 1 year programs are very high quality, yeah, because they all are based for the most part on a year-long internship model. So, and most of them require coursework in the summer prior to the year that they start, and then they do that year-long internship. And then if you want to add on, so you get a license at the end of the year, but then you can usually do a few more credits and get a master's degree, because they're all graduate levels, so you can come out with a master's degree and your certificate.
All right. Thank you. Please proceed.
As we sort of dove into earlier, the barriers that we are seeing to the preparation and graduation of high quality teachers for Alaska schools are money. And then we also have been seeing our graduates, or not quite graduates, experience some difficulties with standardized basic competency exams. And that's a theme that was consistent across the United States when I was at the conference of teacher educator programs last week.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yes.
Senator Begich.
What exactly does that mean? When you say rethinking standardized basic competency exams, what does that mean?
I believe that'll be like the last two slides.
Okay, then I'll wait for that.
If we get around to it, but you can go ahead and cover it now. Yes.
A barrier for a lot of our students is the minimum is called the Praxis Core exam. There are some other alternatives to it, like the SAT.
Just real quick, I noted,
Senator Baggett,
I noted that one of your four examples said the Praxis was one of the barriers. So I just keep going. Sorry.
There is no correlation that has been found between the ability to pass the test and the ability to teach in the classroom. Because all of the people who are taking these exams are already completed a four-year degree program. But programs use them in order to do diagnostic work so you can see where people have strengths and weaknesses and where you might want to beef up the preparation in order to prepare that teacher better to, say, teach math if that's an area that's difficult for them. They also have been shown to keep the wrong people out of the profession. In across the United States, the Black and Latino student pass rates and in Alaska Native student pass rates are lower than those of their white peers, which results in fewer candidates of color and stymies efforts to diversify the workforce. And we have had an opportunity over the last couple of years because COVID greatly impacted our students' ability to take these tests. They weren't offered, and then there were travel issues, and there were all these things. And so we were able to, in collaboration with the State Department of Education, not require them as a condition of graduation. And the state allows districts to issue an emergency license to somebody who's completed all the rest of their program but still hasn't passed the test. And so we have folks, they get an emergency license. They can't get a full license until they do pass the Praxis test, but they can be teaching. So we kind of have this sort of experiment in progress going on right now where we can kind of see and try to collect some data on how effective those teachers are in the classroom as evidence from like their teacher evaluations, despite the fact that they didn't pass the minimum competency test. And I do have a couple of specific stories. And, as you mentioned, one of them is from this this intern teacher who this year is completing her program. And she says she's passed her Praxis Core math and writing, but she's had a difficult time passing her Praxis Core reading due to English being her second language. So she's continued to take the reading test. They take them multiple times over and over. It requires a minimum score of 156, and she's scored as close as 154 and hasn't passed it yet. She says it would be nice if there was an exception for students who are English language learners like herself to be given a chance to pass the test with a few point range below the required passing score. Once obtaining the teaching certificate, if she's unable to continue to teach, that will be the barrier to fulfill her dreams of becoming a qualified, certified teacher in Alaska, and that would be extremely disappointing. And then I also had an opportunity recently to visit with Dr. Mark Stock, who's the deputy superintendent for the Anchorage School District, and he is also sort of passionate about seeing these as a potentially unnecessary barrier to getting more people in the classroom. He says he knows a candidate with a 3.8 GPA and a bachelor's degree from a Research 1 accredited university with 5 years of experience as a paraprofessional in special education. He was highly trained in teaching strategies for non-traditional students and had a significant training in science-based reading initiatives before even going back to college. She took the Praxis test twice and narrowly missed the cut scores due to test anxiety with the algebra portions of the math. She wants to teach second grade, but she can't. So to deal with teacher shortages, he says we must first increase the number of candidates in the pipeline and let employers determine the effectiveness of on the job. So that's from Dr. Mark Stock, and I appreciate his willingness to share that story. So one alternative that I heard about just from the Department of Education here in Alaska last week is that the Washington State, the legislature, removed the requirement to meet a minimum passing score. But we still use the preparation programs still use the test results as a formative assessment of academic strengths and weaknesses to determine candidate readiness for the program.
Senator Baggage?
Thank you. I just want to make a personal comment. I've said this before, but I took the PSAT tests and didn't do well in high school because I had test anxiety, so I never took the SATs. I ended up effectively bluffing my way into pretty prestigious universities by doing other things, I wouldn't pass the Praxis algebra test, and so I couldn't teach here. And so I think it's worth noting that, you know, the tests themselves may be significant barriers to qualified people potentially teaching in areas that aren't even, you know, that are covered by the Praxis test, but where you wouldn't even potentially be teaching. So I think that that's worth noting.
Thanks, Senator Begich. I think one of the examples was the teacher having difficulty passing algebra, but she wants to be a second grade teacher. And there, I don't know how much use algebra is in teaching second grade, but please proceed.
So we did look at this earlier, this notion about affordability and the fact that high quality teacher preparation does lead to higher retention rates in the profession. And so, as I mentioned, we're working with Prepared to Teach. We're in partnership with the Alaska Gateway School District, the Anchorage School District, the Fairbanks School District. We're also continuing partnerships with the Bering Strait School District and the Lower Kuskokwim School District to look towards these strategies for braided funding streams to create sustainable systems to financially support teacher education candidates, not just in tuition, but also in their living costs. And so one of the things on this slide shows that up to two-thirds of the cost of college is related to living expenses, and the tuition can often be defrayed through scholarships, but living costs are rarely defrayed. And we definitely, as I've shown already in this presentation, have students who experience these cost barriers, particularly around living costs. We envision that this would be a market-based collaborative model for the state of Alaska, where different programs at all three universities could be partnering with different school districts to create these deep partnerships, where the district and the university are working together to ensure braided funding streams to meet the financial needs of the students, and also create preparation programs that are deeply tied to the needs of the specific school district. One nice example that has come about recently, this is a partnership in a school district in Tennessee. I went to a session that they held at the AACTE meeting last week. And the university, the school district, so the school district is the one making the choices about who they're going to partner with, and they can have multiple partnerships depending on the degree pathways. So, for example, this district is partnered with Austin Peay State University on a undergraduate pathway for classified employees, community members, high school seniors who want to get a teaching license, and they have worked together to braid their funding streams to support the students in this program on their pathway to becoming a teacher. And then if you already have a bachelor's degree, the same district is working with a different university on their post-bac pathways to licensure, and also working on sustainable funding strategies there. So we envision that a single district in Alaska could, for example, be working with UAF on an elementary undergraduate pathway partnership, and they could be working with UAA on an early childhood pathway partnership. They could be working with UA Southeast on a special education post-bac partnership, and that would be based on the specific needs of the individual district. And then there is this opportunity, this sort of exciting area that's opening up around Department of Labor apprenticeships. And I think someone mentioned earlier that a lot of careers are eligible for financial support from the federal government. And the teaching profession is an apprenticeable profession by federal regulation. So if we can make teachers here eligible for apprenticeship dollars, we could potentially tap into the unspent dollars in workforce programs. Those are federal dollars, and they're in the neighborhood of a billion unspent dollars a year in workforce programs from the federal government. So this is not state money, it's federal money. And that's a heck of a lot more than is allocated by the federal government to support, for example, TEACH grants. I have heard word that federal Department of Labor dollars, more of them are likely to flow soon and potentially targeted specifically towards teaching apprenticeships. And so the idea is that you have a partnership-based residency model that meets Department of Labor requirements for apprenticeship dollars. The schools are the center, so the districts are the center of the apprenticeship model that they house the apprenticeship program, but they need to be in partnership with higher education institutions to get the related coursework to build out those apprenticeships. So partnerships need to mobilize, like we're starting to do or have already been working on in our state here, to capitalize on the opportunity and define those residency apprenticeships. And I think that's it. I made it through all of it.
Director Vinlove, thank you so much. Are there any other questions from the committee? Senator Hughes.
Yes, I am wondering, and forgive me if I don't have it characterized correctly in my head, the student teaching portion of getting the bachelor's degree, has there been any consideration of moving that right into more of an internship? Because my experience is a long time ago, and I was substitute teaching. I was working on my teaching degree. I ended up not going that route. But it didn't seem like when somebody came into a student teach, it was just more like checking off the box, you know, to get their credit so they could get their degree. And what I witnessed was the school district wasn't really invested in making sure that person became a great teacher. But if that student teacher came more in like a resident, an intern resident, it seemed like that mentoring would have been more. And I'm just wondering if there's some way to combine. We don't want to, you know, make it easier, as Senator Stevens, but actually make that time more valuable. And so the district would be invested, and they'd also get a stipend for that period rather than checking off a box, paying tuition, and, you know, taking care of it. Is it one semester or two? I mean, is there any – it's two, so it's a whole year. So what about making that be the residency year? Because I'm not sure if it's as valuable as – because you're talking about doing a year of student teaching and then – doing a year of residency? No, you're talking about making that year of student teaching. Okay, good. That helps because I think that's going to – I'm guessing there are certain people after their student teaching, because if they're not getting the support from the school district, they may get their degree and never actually go in the classroom and teach. I'm guessing that happens to some. So that's very, very good news. The other thing I just want to mention really quickly, Mr. Chair, is I, like Senator Beckett, from someone who came back to Alaska, my husband and I both did, because of the forgiveness. And the beauty of it is you didn't get, you know, the check wasn't waving for you to come back and grab. You had to come back and be here and be, you know, working. And then you got it at the end of the period. So that kind of an incentive where it's after you'd come back and do the work, I think that is something we might want to consider.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Begich.
I was just going to say one of the issues that's come up when we've testified on Senate Bill 111 for before the Finance Committee is Senator Bishop has said over and over again, citing his experience as Commissioner of Labor, that there was unspent federal funds in labor. Couldn't we find a way to move that into these efforts? And so I just think that we have a willing audience in the Finance Committee for exactly this kind of approach.
All right, thanks, Senator Begich. You know, we have a little bit of time left over. Oh, Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you. Could you address a little bit, Dr. Vinlove, the issue of accreditation? I know you've been involved in that. I successfully chaired an accreditation team that received its accreditation, and we were all shocked, as I'm sure you were, when University of Alaska Anchorage lost its accreditation for the School of Education there. Has that affected the students coming through the University of Alaska Anchorage? Have we worked around that? Are we finding ways to make it work? In any event, which I suspect we are, but are there plans to eventually work towards accreditation for University of Alaska Anchorage education programs?
Well, the University of Alaska Anchorage is currently accredited under CAPE for its advanced program pathways. In terms of their initial licensure pathways, they just got approval from the State Department of Education to open up a four-year degree program. So it's kind of a chicken and egg kind of a situation, because you need to have students in order to pursue accreditation, but you need permission to enroll those students before you can go for accreditation. So they now have that permission, and they will have the opportunity to reapply for their initial licensure accreditation in a few years after starting up that degree pathway again. But in the meantime, like at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, we actually have faculty who live and work in Anchorage. We offer face-to-face courses in all of our initial licensure pathway programs down there. The University of Alaska Southeast also offers initial licensure programs to anybody across the state through distance delivery, and also have faculty based in Anchorage. So we do have existing programs that are accredited that are available on the UAA campus in initial licensure. So there was never a gap there in terms of the offerings or the ability for someone to receive that initial licensure through the University of Alaska as a result of that accreditation. We really marshaled our forces and worked collaboratively across the system. We absorbed it at my institution, you know, somewhere upwards of 80 to 100 students. I mean, and like almost 40 of them were in their final semester of preparation, and we allowed them to transfer into our program so that they could graduate. They didn't have to move. All of our programs allow you to stay where you're at while you complete the program. We had, that was before we had faculty in Anchorage, but by that summer we had hired and had full-time faculty and advisors who live and work in Anchorage.
That's good to hear. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, for me.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's important also to note that slide of yours that showed the decline that occurred nationally by, you know, as I think it was 20-30%, whatever it was. It was from 900,000 to 600,000. Because that occurs at the same time that our graduate numbers are decreasing. So I've contemplated this, you know, I guess, accusational attitude toward our university, but this is just reflecting a trend that's happening nationally. And so that makes it incumbent upon us to figure out a way to change that trend. So,
Senator Hughes.
On the Praxis score competency exam questions, we had looked into it and noticed that some of our requirements were lower than what other states. And I understand what you're saying. Somebody English second language might have difficulty with the reading assessment. And like we did with the SB 111, our read by nine, read early intervention and all of that, we have allow different pathways for assessment because of test anxiety and different things. It kind of bothers me to think that we might be accepting that, okay, teachers don't need to have this knowledge base. And I understand a second grade teacher doesn't need to know how to do complicated algebra, for instance, but maybe I would feel more comfortable if I knew high school teachers, for instance, that someone's teaching chemistry or whatever actually is as competent, you know, that we are among the states to have the most competent chemistry teachers. And so is there any work to figure out how to maybe do alternate testing or to tease out, oh, yeah, okay, a second grade teacher doesn't need to know how to do geometry and algebra. So we know that they are as competent as they need to be for what they are teaching. I don't like just to dismiss it and say, okay, we're not going to require that. I want to have the best teachers in the nation.
And I want to make it clear that there are actually two different sort of buckets of tests that our pre-service teachers have to take. There's the basic competency, but then there are the content area specific exams, and we're not recommending that there be any changes with it. There's a lot of different ways to achieve content, to demonstrate content area knowledge. And one of them is these Praxis 2 tests, which is different from the Praxis core. So a person teaching chemistry in a secondary program would need to pass that competency exam to demonstrate that in the event that they didn't already have a major in chemistry, which is another way to demonstrate that competency. But there are two different buckets there. And it's just these basic competency exams that are proving to be kind of a hurdle for particularly folks who have are English language learners or have test anxiety.
And a follow-up?
A follow-up.
So, I mean, you're not suggesting we just get rid of them doing that. What I'm wondering is, are we developing some kind of alternative to make sure, even at that core level, that the teachers are ready? I don't want to just say, oh, okay, some of them can't pass it, let's get rid of it. Are we figuring out an alternative pathway for those that don't pass it to make sure that they're ready?
And there are, as you mentioned, there are alternative pathways for both the basic competency exams as well as the content area exams. But in the basic competency area, there's no pathway that doesn't involve a standardized time test.
And I'll say that Sandra Meredith is on the line. And Ms. Meredith, if you can hear me, do you have any thoughts on the current question?
Through the chair, this is Sandra Meredith, Administrator for Teacher Certification. In the Washington example that was provided or put forward by Dr. Vinlove, what they are doing is actually providing the universities with the means to develop those alternate pathways to prove proficiencies in those different areas when a candidate is having difficulty passing the basic competency exam. So that would be a mechanism that that Alaska could choose to go to as well.
Thank you, Ms. Meredith. I tell you, we're about at the end of the committee meeting time. I'll just go back to Superintendent McManus. If you have any final thoughts on discussions, any closing thoughts, and I'll go to Director Vinlove.
Yes, thank you, Chair Holland. I'm getting an echo, sorry. Yeah, I really appreciate the committee's time here today. I think this is a very important conversation. I recently learned about the Department of Labor money for apprenticeships or internships. I think that is a very exciting development from my perspective. And I think that, you know, as we sort of try to figure out all possible solutions to one of the biggest problems that we have in education, not just in Alaska, but everywhere, which is putting quality teachers in front of students in their classrooms and being able to engage them. So exciting stuff. I'm glad to be part of it. I'm very excited with what the university is doing and that I'm able to be a part of that as well. So I'd like to thank the university for their role and their leadership in this as well. Thank you.
And Superintendent, you do believe that these apprenticeship programs are doable and remote access of some of Alaska's the environments? I believe you were talking about you're able to kind of force your way into getting a program earlier, but if you provide some thoughts on that.
I can be quite persistent, so that's a useful trait sometimes. I do think it's possible. I've seen it done. I do believe that there's value in teachers, especially students, spending some time with other students face-to-face. I think that's a unique opportunity. But I also know there are some realities. We have teachers, or we have, you know, possible teachers who are, you know, 40 and 50 years old. They have families to support. In some cases, these are the primary breadwinners of their home. They cannot just pick up and go to the university campus. The opportunities do exist, especially, I think, most especially with the addition of this practical hands-on component of internships in the classroom. So I think that really creates a much more viable solution. And I do think it can happen, yes.
Thank you, Superintendent. Dr. Vinlove, do you have any closing thoughts?
I think that this is a very exciting time for opportunities to be pursued that really strengthen the connections between the universities and our K-12 districts. I think we're at a point in history where It's do or die. If we don't work together, we're not going to have any teachers for our schools. And I think that that really incentivizes a much deeper level of collaboration and mutually beneficial partnership than we've seen in the past. And I'm excited to have district partners like Alaska Gateway and the other partners we're working with. And just very grateful for the opportunity to share with you today. So thank you.
One last thing. Where in the presentation was that website on if people are interested in educational opportunities?
Very, very first slide there, the teachalaska.org.
Okay. I went right by it. Teachalaska.org. You can get on that and kind of
poke around and see our programs.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Venlove. Thank you, Superintendent McManus. Is there any other business before the committee? At this time, I'll set Senate Bill 225 aside. Our next meeting is Friday, March 11th at 9 a.m., and we are adjourned at 10:33.